Shabbat shalom, everybody. Good morning. My colleagues and I are here in our favorite place in the world, the Gann Chapel. It is Wednesday, January 10th. We're here with Andrew taping us, and this is being shown on Shabbat of Martin Luther King weekend, Parshat Va'era. I wanted to frame the content by telling you how excited I am to talk about this content, because I was studying Va'era this week, as I always do, and it dawned on me that the same very short Hebrew word, ot, olive, Vav, Tav. One word, conveys both the agony and the angst of this new year, 2024, January. It's our second Shabbat in 2024. Ot conveys the absolute agony and the absolute angst and the anguish of 2024. But the same word, ot, in biblical Hebrew and in our lived Jewish practice, has a completely different meaning, a secondary meaning, which provides a healing and helpful response to the agony of 2024. The same single, short, little three-letter word, ot, is both the problem and, in a very real sense, the solution. So cannot wait to get into our content. Let's thank Hashem for the gift of learning Torah together. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam, asher kidishanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu la'asok b'divrei Torah. Barem na Adonai Eloheinu et divrei Toratcha b'finu v'fi amcha b'Yisrael v'nihyeh anachnu v'tzatzaeinu v'tzatzaei amcha b'Yisrael kulanu yodei shemecha v'lamdei Toratecha lishma baruch atah Adonai hamalamei Torah la'amo Yisrael baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam shebach arbanu mikol ha'amim natan lanu et Torato baruch atah Adonai natein ha'Torah. Fabulous thing about Torah is that if you're in a lifelong relationship with Torah, you know, the Torah portion doesn't change, but you change, and what you've experienced, what you've read, have changed. And now you see something and it pops in a completely different way. So I want to talk about the first definition of ot, or in the plural, otot, moftim, signs and wonders. So we're beginning the Exodus liberation story, Va'era, and God says to Moses, oh my God, I've got these otot u'moftim. I've got these signs and wonders. And they're just so powerful. They're going to suspend nature. You're going to show a rod that turns into a snake. And if Pharaoh can do the same thing, your snake is going to eat up his snake. And then we're going to turn the Nile into blood. And we're going to get frogs and lice and all the 10 plagues. And this is just going to persuade the unpersuaded Pharaoh that I am God. And there's the whole hardening of the heart business. But the bottom line is that all these super signs and wonders to convince the unconvinced do not convince the unconvinced. And as I read the portion, it made me think about the famous story in Bava Metzia, the Tanur Shel Achnai, where Rabbi Eliezer is disputing with his colleagues, and he's a minority view. And he says, my view is right. And he says, I can prove it with basically a totem of team, signs and wonders. I'm going to prove it by showing that this carob tree is just going to pick up and move. And I'm going to prove it by showing that water, instead of flowing this way, the way it should flow, will flow that way. All of which nature itself is chiming in and saying, I'm right and you're wrong. And they say proof can't be brought from a carob tree. And it made me realize that in our own very contentious age, there is no splendid visual, no spectacular oat, no sign and wonder that you can show that is going to convince anybody of anything, right? We live in an age that is highly polarized, highly toxically polarized, and no proof, no visual, no argument, no podcast, no lecture, no picture, no video, nothing convinces the other side. So I wanted to just first, and then what changed for me, I mean, we've known that for a while. We know that the plagues don't work. And we know that even after the 10th plague, which seems like it works, Pharaoh finally says, okay, go already. Already then he changes his mind and he's still not convinced even after the 10th plague, even after his own son dies, even after there's no house in Egypt without a dead son, Pharaoh changes his mind and sends the army after the Israelites, and only Kriyat Yamsuf resolves the issue. So we know that signs and wonders don't convince the unconvinced. But I saw something that I wanted to bring to the table that helped me really understand it. So first question is, how have you experienced this phenomenon ourselves that you might be jumping up and down with a totem of teams, signs and wonders, splendid arguments, spectacular visuals, proof like a smoking gun, and you present it to the other side, and they say, nah, just doesn't matter. I don't see it. Anyone want to just speak to that for a moment?
I want to jump in first. One of the things that I think God does, which is so bizarre, is that he sets Moshe up to fail immediately. Because, you know, Moshe throws down the rod, it becomes a snake. And then God knows that all the Egyptian magicians can do the same thing. And then the Nile turns to blood, and all the Egyptian magicians can do the same thing. So why does God start out by allowing Moshe to fail? Mm. So I think that actually is an interesting moment, because this is why it takes all the way to the 10th plague, or something that the magicians can't do. Mm.
I think
that
one explanation, this is just my view, could be that the first time we are saying, look, we are Jews and we are no less than you. Mm-hmm. We've been slaves, but look what we can do. We can match up with exactly what you're doing.
Well, so how would you answer your own question, Dan, by the way?
I'm not sure.
The case that our rod eats up their rod, our snake eats up their snake. But but the point that you bring up is, right, also visuals and spectacular videos and amazing lectures and amazing photographs. Part of the reason they don't have that punch is there's always another photograph. But what about this picture? What about our argument? What about this video?
I think that that's really kind of the answer. The answer is, been there, done that. This is, you're not really proving anything. You're not really changing anything by what you're doing.
Mm. Michelle.
My answer to you, Dan, would be maybe to help us today to understand that this is not a one-off, that sometimes we, the world that we experience is the world that Moses experienced as well, which sets the template that you keep on going even when you're not seen, you're not believed, you're not heard. Mm. Maybe. But in answer to your original question that you posed, I mean, there's an obvious glaring example that jumps out, which is October 8th. You know, how is it that Jews are slaughtered on October 7th in the most brutal, vicious, vile ways, and ways that when you read about the gender-based violence that happened in that moment in the New York Times, you know, even a couple months later, are so searing and scarring. And the next day, people are out with, you know, liberate Palestine from the river to the sea, and that's the response. So the complete lack of lining up of your read of the world and somebody else's read of the world, to me, is October 8th.
Yeah, so October 8th, you know, luridly stands for the proposition there is no convincing, right? That is to say, there's no argument with reason, and there's no potent sign and wonder, there's no visual, there's no amazing pyrotechnic that can convince the unconvinced. Just try talking to your kids or grandkids about Israel if they have different opinions. There's just no, right? And I wanted to hear, but that, what's so we've known that. What's new in this conversation is I wanted to explain an insight as to why that is. But first, Elise and Elias.
So it's interesting for me. I want to take a step back from the intensity and seriousness of October 7th, 8th, and beyond, because we had a weird moment this morning putting together our new playpen, where I was sure that it needed to close on the top first and then the bottom. And Solomon was like, no, it doesn't. And I was like, no, it absolutely does. And then he showed me it can close on the bottom and then the top. And I was like, no, you still need to do it on the top and the bottom. And it was this moment, like, made for this class, because there was evidence. I saw it in front of me, and I was still determined. And I was thinking about, you know, it's I find myself in a lot of moments frustrated about someone else or some other party that's not listening. And I was just thinking about, what am I doing? What is my spiritual practice of listening, of paying attention, of asking myself, like, why do I know the things that I know, and how do I know the things that I know? And it made me realize that I have work to do on the space of, you know, not just about the playpen, which you can close on the top and on the bottom, either one works first, but though I still think it's better on the top, for the record. But there's a spiritual practice of preparing ourselves to listen and being open to that. And that I don't know how that shapes the global conversation, but I do know that there, I have a part in this dynamic of not listening.
So let me just jump in with the new idea, that the new content that I learned, that to me anyway was like a light bulb turning on. At 62 years old, a light bulb turned on. And I couldn't understand, Alan, just to be candid, not to talk politics, but I couldn't understand why, when the indictment came down about the documents case, I mean, these are confidential national documents that are supposed to be under lock and key and seal, and they were found on the basement, on the floor of a bathroom in a hotel, but not concealed, not protected, and they were splashed on the front page of every newspaper. And yet, if you were to ever talk about the issue with somebody who has a different conviction, those photographs were of zero import. No more than a film of October 7th would persuade somebody on October 8th. No more would the photographs of national, confidential, top secret security information splashed around on the bathroom floor for the whole world to see on every newspaper. It had zero impact. And I was wondering, what is that? What is that? And finally, I got the answer. So I was listening to, and it's in the packet, but Andy Stanley was doing a leadership podcast with a woman named Sheila Heen. So Sheila Heen, if you haven't listened to the Andy Stanley podcast, she heads the negotiation workshop at Harvard Law School. Years ago, Roger Fisher did it. He wrote the book Getting to Yes, and it's a whole class about how do you have a hard conversation where both parties can get to win-win. How do you get to yes? And Roger Fisher was the progenitor of this program. Sheila Heen is running it now. She wrote a book called Having Difficult Conversations, and she's talking to Andy Stanley, and then she says something where the light bulb goes off, and it just kind of like untied the Gordian knot. She says, every hard conversation has three levels. The least important conversation is the facts, what happened. Almost doesn't matter what happened. The second layer of conversation is the emotion conversation. How do you feel about what happened? And then the third level, which is the most important and shapes the other two, is what Sheila Heen calls the identity conversation. Whose team are you on? What jersey are you wearing when you hear the conversation? That completely shapes how you feel. Indeed, that completely shapes what you see and what you don't see. And then I realize that this ironclad law of nature, that the emotion conversation takes precedence, that the team identity conversation takes precedence over emotion, takes precedence for sure over fact, applies to everybody, including me, which is why, as we've discussed over the months since October 7th, I don't really see, have not been able to see or focus on the Gaza civilians, and I'm not alone. Daniel Hartman and Yossi Klein Halevi did a whole podcast, their 19th podcast of Israel at War, was about how Israelis are not talking about the civilians in Gaza, because it's what team are you on, what emotion do you bring to the conversation that shapes what you see, that shapes what you don't see. So Team Pharaoh could not see the plagues, and Team the former president cannot see the evidence. But the truth is, Team Israel and the Jewish people, many of us, myself included, cannot see the Gaza civilians. Team Free Palestine cannot see October 7th. So I guess I want to come back to you, Aliza. If Sheila Heen is right, well, first of all, do you agree or not agree? But if to the extent that you think there's something to what she says, what would the work look like to deal with that?
Yeah, so I think very much that's the same question, which is like, how open are you to hearing a different perspective? I definitely agree with that. I also think it's not always about team or tribe. It's also sometimes about like how willing are you to think of another possibility or to be open to another way of moving. And that doesn't necessarily have to do with tribe, but like think about operating in Jewish community and somebody does a tradition a different way than you do. And you're like, no, that's not how it goes. And there's all these, you know, that happens in Israel all the time where people are corrected because they're not doing Ashkenazi practice, they're doing Sephardic practice, and there's not a lot of openness to new possibilities or new way of doing things. Mm. I think that there's also a difference for me in what Pharaoh experiences, because there's a difference between being shown demonstrably that a playpen can be open and closed and saying, you know, I'm setting national policy and suddenly water turns into blood, and that's not necessarily a direct, it's a sign and a wonder for sure, but I'm not sure that it's unreasonable for Pharaoh not to listen, like not to be like, I think that's magic, not a direct consequence of my actions. Mm.
Elias, how do you hear the Sheila Heen gloss on A Totem of Team? That is, signs and wonders are never as strong as group identity that shapes how you see the world.
Definitely. I agree 100% with that article. Thank you for bringing it up, because I think it's fantastic. I'm going to also bring something, a comparison that it's a little silly, just to light up a little bit the class. I'm a huge soccer fan, and for the last 10, 15 years, the world of soccer has debate which of the two main soccer players is better, Ronaldo or Messi. Messi being Argentinian, to me, there is no doubt.
Right.
Okay?
You're from Argentina?
Yes.
Okay.
So Messi, to me, is the greatest player in history. And Ronaldo has scored the most amount of goals in history. No other player has scored more goals. So I read the news and I read the people making comments. I cannot understand why people would choose Ronaldo over Messi. They can show me the most beautiful ever goal scored by Cristiano Ronaldo. I would say, eh. All right? So there are wonders, obviously. I cannot see it. Why? Because my emotions are in the place. Or this idea that we can even talk a whole lesson about it, that why it's either one or the other.
Right.
Right? This idea that I'm right, you're wrong.
Right.
Right? And there is no common ground. That's it. Or the opposite is that you are right, I'm wrong. There is nothing in between.
Right. So, Elias, I think I love that example because it's so, first of all, it's safe. And second of all, it's concrete. Right? You wear the light blue and white Argentinian jersey, and literally that jersey shapes the conversation for you. And you could see 1 million videos of the other guy scoring crazy goals, and you could see 1 million statistics. None of those signs and wonders are as strong as your jersey, Sheila Heen. It's the identity that shapes what you feel, that shapes what you see and what you don't see. My question to you, my friend, when you move from soccer to America in an election year, when you move from soccer to Israel as it's trying to emerge from this war in a post-Gaza reality, what does the power of the jersey suggest to you about how we behave?
Anyways, can somebody else answer that?
Anybody, and that's for anybody. And then I'm happy to. I want to throw that out there, because of the power of the jersey is the most powerful thing. It's even more powerful than God and God's word. I mean, Pharaoh in the end, even after the 10th plague, his jersey is more. Team Pharaoh is more important than anything. So then the question I'll ask, and then I'm going to shift, is, so what do we do? Like, we're living in an age with toxic division. And both in our country and in our homeland, so many big questions, like, what is America going to be? What is Israel going to be? And there's so much deep division, and the person with the Argentinian jersey can't see the other side. And we can't see the other side because of our... So what do we do? How do we live? So I wanted to pivot. So that's the problem, the angst, the agony. And if, to the extent that you've ever actually tried to have a reasonable conversation, you've bumped up against the power of jersey, and it's futile and painful. So what's a different move? So the word oat has a whole other meaning, and that's the solution, that is the healing. But I wanted to first read out loud and get your wisdom on a Harold Schulweis paragraph. So Harold Schulweis was truly one of the great, great rabbis of modern time. He was at Valley Beth Shalom in California. And he wrote this book in 1990 called In God's Mirror. And he's a Zaydi, a grandfather. And he writes this article about, what am I supposed to tell my grandchildren about the 10 plagues, you know, the miracle stories in the book of Exodus. So I'm just going to read this and ask you for your response, because this is going to help us pivot to solution and to healing. Rabbi Schulweis writes, "The signs," that's otot, that's our word of the day, "the signs of God are found not in the reports of the changes in the natural order of things, but in nature's orderliness. God is discovered in the intelligibility of the universe rather than in its capriciousness. For its intelligibility enables human beings to exercise their intelligence and will to hallow creation. The evening service, Maariv, begins with the praise of God who with wisdom orders the cycles of time and varies the seasons. Significantly, it is followed with a prayer that emphasizes the wisdom that the house of Israel shares through God's teachings. The miracles that are daily with us are in us and are revealed through us when we use our God-given moral wisdom to protect and enhance God's creation. So what do you think Rabbi Schulweis is saying? And what's the move that he makes in that one paragraph with ot, with the word ot, with the word sign?
Yeah, so I think what he's doing is he seems to be like almost trying to turn human nature around, because as you said, it's in the Sheen article, it's very clear how we actually understand the world. And I think what he's saying is that yes, that's the way we understand the world, but it's also there's also even a deeper layer, and that deeper layer is how we can learn to experience the world in a different way if we open ourselves up more to the concept of oats and the concept of a longer game, towards understanding the world through a sense of eternity, I think is what he's trying to point out there.
Yeah, let me build on that eternity. So just the oat, at first blush, seems to be that we're going to suspend the natural order, and the Nile's going to turn to blood, etc. And he says that's not an oat that he believes in, and therefore the whole notion that I can prove to you that I'm right and you're wrong, that I can convince you based on my supernatural signs and wonders, it's not going to work. Instead, he says, ot is a sign of an eternal truth that is always true, that is predictable, that is intelligible, that you can bank on, that you can live on. Mm-hmm. And I want to bring, and I just want to build on that energy. So it turns out, I think, I'm sure there are others, but there's three otot, three signs that take us to a completely different place, not to arguing with somebody about Trump or Hamas or Gaza, a completely different place. Otot that are signs of eternal truths that are always true. So one is Shabbat, which is an ot, always true. One is prayer, talis and tefillin, we wear during regular days, chol, but during chol moed we don't, because we already have the ot of the holiday, so we don't need the ot of talis and tefillin. And the other ot is love, the wedding ring that many people wear, that is a physical sign of the covenant of love. So Shabbat every week, prayer every day, and eternal covenantal love. Those are all otot, and those are signs that are eternally true. And it feels to me like a response to the unpleasantness and the agony of signs and wonders that don't work and don't convince is to rededicate ourselves to these truths that are always true, to Shabbat with the community, to individual prayer, and to deepening our love with our family and friends, our home and hearth. And that is a helpful and healing response to 2024. So let me just throw that out there.
Yeah, I want to put something in the table that has been concerning me since October 7, which is for decades, and in a positive way, rabbis and sages have been trying to reinterpret a lot of the tales that we have in the Torah in order to make it more approachable and more accessible for regular people who don't necessarily believe in wonders or believe in God. But that creates a conundrum. I'm so good with English these days. That creates a conundrum, which is, now with all seriousness, which is that there are so many people who hate us that are questioning our connection to the land. So we have on one hand, we trying to say to our own next generations, I'm not so sure that happened. It's more like a tale. Right? And it's a teaching moment from that tale, with the other people saying, the ones who hate us, you see, it's a tale. They don't have any connection. It's only creation. You cannot rely on the Bible with the Jewish people to the connection to Israel. So I've been struggling with that. Well, can you guys help me with that?
I love this, because you're going exactly where I've been wrestling for this whole conversation and previous to this conversation. You know, I grew up in Los Angeles over the hill from Rabbi Schulweis. This is the kind, his teaching is the kind of teaching that not only learned from the very beginning, but has really been a foundation of how I've approached the world, how I've approached my rabbinate, right? We see the miracles that are in every day. We connect with people. We work together to cross boundaries, to see each other more deeply. If there's something that I'm not understanding, that means I have to work harder, go deeper, try to understand the other side better. And I think that's so important. It's so critical to our toolboxes as liberal Jews.
There's a but coming.
Yeah, there's a big but.
What's the but?
Coming, which is the question that Elias raises is profoundly troubling to that. No matter how much I try to see or empathize or reach or create a shared conversation or even try to understand that other side, that other perspective, they're not engaged in the same work.
Yeah.
And when I give up the faith, the hope, the belief, when I tell my children, you know, as you know, famously, Rabbi Wolpe, a neighbor of Rabbi Schulweis and now a neighbor of ours, you know, famously hit the newspapers all over by saying the Exodus didn't really happen. You know,
he didn't say
20
it
years,
happen.
20
he did
years
not say
ago.
It didn't happen. He raised a question.
He made national news by saying that the way we read it does not have to be
right, the
way that it is, that we can use it as a metaphor,
right,
that we can use it as a story that binds our people together,
yeah,
and that it actually doesn't matter.
Ethnicity doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter whether
right,
the facts actually were the facts. And right. I mean, I was right there with him. I that makes a lot of sense to me. And now Elias's question, right, is actually a little thorn in my side. Like, am I teaching my children right when I say it doesn't matter? Because maybe it matters that there were signs and wonders and a God that comes in on our side that we need to call into our world today with an act of pleading and faith to help us repair a world where no amount of me trying to see the other side is going to make that repair.
By the way, here's one answer to your question, Elias, and a response to you, Michelle. This point of view is not from Harold Schulweis or David Wolpe in the late 20th century. If you read Harold Schulweis's article, he quotes the Mishnah, Rosh Hashanah 3:8. The rabbis themselves are troubled at two stories in the Torah. One is Aharon and Hur holding up Moses' hands when they fight Amalek. And can it be, the Mishnah asks this question, Rosh Hashanah 3:8, can it be that when his hands are up, that they win, and when his hands go down, they lose? That's black magic. That couldn't be. And the rabbis themselves in the Mishnah say, no, you're supposed to take that metaphorically, that when the Israelites are devoted to God's way, they'll do better. And when they're not devoted to God's way, they'll do worse. And then they do it a second time in the same Mishnah. Could it be that when somebody was bitten by a snake, that if they look at a bronzed snake, they'll feel better? That couldn't be. That's black magic. No, rather that when they look at that bronze snake and then they subjugate their hearts to heaven, then that life of piety and devotion will heal them. It's not the serpent snake. So what Harold Schulweis's point is 2,000 years old, and his basis for it is the Mishnah, which is the foundation of Judaism. But I want to just come back to the basic question here, which is, if there's no and as our time is ending, if there's no convincing, the title of this class is There's No Convincing. We live in a toxic age of polarization. And what feels different about 2024 is that both in our home and in our homeland, the very fate of our civilization is at stake. And the very fate of our civilization is up for grabs. And about, you know, there's significant division in both countries, our home and our homeland, about what should America look like, what should Israel look like. And you can't reason your way out of it, and you can't argue your way out of it. And even if you have 10 plagues and signs and wonders and a rod that turns into a snake for no extra charge, you cannot persuade the other side, because signs and wonders don't work because of the messy journey, because of the Argentina journey, because of the power of journey, Sheila Heen. And the question that I want to tee up for us, that we're early in 2024, is this other definition of OAT, a helpful response. That is to say, focus on prayer, focus on Shabbat, focus on love, focus on your spouse, focus on your children, focus on your parents, focus on your siblings, focus on your family, focus on your loved ones. Focus on that. Don't focus on the negative energy you can't control. Focus on the positive energy that you can control. That's OAT. As a response to OAT, let's just close and ask if that works for you or not. Lisa?
Super does not work for me.
Tell me more.
Because the paradigm that we've laid out is that when you are attached to your tribe, Sheila Heen, you cannot be open to new information. You're not open to signs. You're not open to the possibility of changing your mind. And so then the answer of OAT, get deeper into your tribe, get deeper into your life cycle practices, get deeper into your family, get deeper into your hearth, to me just creates more and more separation. When it feels like to me the work that we have to do is not about beating people over the head with signs and being like, shh, look at this is the thing. It's about working to find common ground. It's about making a new jersey and figuring out what's a jersey that we can all wear together. It's about finding common experiences. It's about having those conversations. So I think...
Does that ever work? Have you ever seen that work?
Yeah, I have seen it work.
What's
it
an
takes
example
a lot
of that working?
A lot of time.
What's an example of that working?
An example of that working is a couple of years ago, I had a student here, a young adult, who was very upset about Israel and was talking about how the reality in Israel maps onto the reality of blacks and whites in this country. We went on a long walk, and I talked with her about how the history doesn't match up and how I totally get her deep compassion in the way that she feels, and it's important the way that she feels about what's happening for the Palestinians. This was years ago before any of this current situation. We had a long, long conversation, and my goal in that conversation was to see her and to affirm that I totally am with her and I see where she's coming from and I am there too. And to also affirm that there are other things to think about and there are other realities and there are other truths and places that she could gather more information. And at the beginning of this conflict, she actually came in and met with me to say that she was sorry for that conversation, that she totally saw, that she was grateful that I'd taken the time to talk with her, and she sees it now, she gets it now. And she's really upset now with her friends who are not getting it. So I think it's difficult work and it's slow. It's so slow. You have that conversation. You don't, like, I had no idea for years. But it's really important and crucially important. And I think that, you know, we didn't go back to this. You included this incredibly helpful application guide from Andy Stanley and Sheila Heen, which is really important. I think there are steps that are laid out here, including the step of owning your own role in this. That's incredibly important. Being humble to the possibility that the signs and wonders that you see might not actually be signs and wonders, and that there might be other ways of seeing them. And also thinking about, what do I share? Where can I join with you? If we totally disagree about something, how do I think about a way to access the conversation where we can find common ground and a common jersey, so then together we can look at the signs and wonders that exist for us and maybe arrive at a different conclusion. But it only works if you're authentically also open to having your mind changed.
In fairness, though, that has to be a limited band of people you can do that with. Otherwise, you can't have that kind of humble listening tour with somebody who tears down posters of the hostages, right? Right? I would assume. If somebody
why not?
Why not?
Yeah.
Well, could you do it with an out-and-out anti-Semite? Could you do it with somebody who says the Jewish people are colonizers, there should not be a Jewish state? You would sit down and have that conversation?
For sure.
For sure.
I think we have to, because what's the alternative?
There's no convincing. Okay, well, let's just close. Colleagues,
can I say something?
Please weigh in.
I definitely believe that we should stick to OAT, because that's who we are. Especially in times where nobody stands with us. Because the risk is that if we don't study and do our own stuff, that it's our own culture and our own religion, and we invest a lot of time doing other kind of things, we get betrayed, like it happened after October 7. We get betrayed from so many people that we thought they were our friends, and they are not.
Right.
I don't say we should keep doing dialogue. We should. But the core of us is Shabbat and prayer.
Mr. Nelson?
Yeah, I think if we follow, you know, the wisdom of the rabbis and as laid out again with Schulweis, that what happens is that what Elisha said, if we are able to focus on those otot, that could open up the possibility of us being more empathetic and listening to others, and if others can see that we are connected in such a way that it's not only about our own identity, but an identity that's going to be allowing to be open, that others will be able to engage with us as well.
Michelle?
Sheila Heen does have this incredible paradigm for having these hard conversations. And I think it's critical. I mean, I can't turn my back on a lifetime of believing that our task in this world is to try to build bridges. So I believe in building bridges, and I see the limits of the capacity to build those bridges. There are some places and some people with which you can't have the conversations.
Right.
And to me, what that has shaken for me is that my liberal Jewish stake in our texts as metaphor, or even my passion for the Talmudic rabbis who said, how can this be, right? It can't work that way. To me, a Judaism that excludes a God of miracles suddenly isn't working quite as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll just close by saying, I find this a super scary age, and I now have language for why it's so scary, because the king is identity politics. The king is jersey. The king is the jersey that you wear shapes the lens of what you see and don't see. It shapes how you feel or don't feel, and it just feels like in our home and in our homeland, in the same country, people are wearing very floridly different jerseys, which means there is no such thing as truth. There is no such thing as shared facts. Facts don't matter. In the Sheila Heen typology, facts are incidental. They're almost irrelevant, because what matters far more than facts is how you feel about the facts, etc. And all of that is very unsettling to me. Aliza, I love, love, love your spirit, but number one, I find it exhausting. It takes time that nobody has. And to me, it's at most relevant to a very limited band of people. Like, I would do that kind of painful work with our children from our congregation. But I would not do it with random people who hate on Israel. There's so many of them, and there's so few of us, and there's so little time. So it's very limited band. So for me, and I love building bridges, but what happens to bridge building in an age of identity politics where identities are so florid and so far away? So for me, that second definition of oat is just like, how I'm going to wake up in the morning with a heavy heart. How am I going to make it through the day? I find the oat of daily prayer, having a space to commune with fellow Jews in this beautiful space and to commune with God and wrestle with God, is super helpful. I find Shabbat, you know, incredibly helpful, and home and hearth are just ever to be renewed. So for me, for my money, the response to the agony of this age is wedding ring, the Sabbath day, and daily prayer. And I hope that all of you find your own helpful response to that first oat, which is the agony of our age. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shkoach.